Today is Monday, August the 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, sitting in for Lori Landon, who is out for the next 2 days. These are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. The United States is in a new phase of the novel coronavirus outbreak. Top health official warns that the virus is spreading in rural areas as well as cities.
Dr. Deborah Birx, the White House Coronavirus Task Force coordinator, told CNN's State of the Union, quote, "What we are seeing today is different from March and April."
The White House and top congressional Democrats remain at odds over the scope of more assistance for 30 million American workers left unemployed by the coronavirus pandemic. And two NASA astronauts returned to Earth on Sunday in a dramatic retro-style splashdown, the first of its kind in 45 years. Stay with us. These stories and more are on today's International Edition. The United States is in a new phase of the novel coronavirus outbreak, with infections widespread in rural areas as well as cities. Lisa Barnard reports.
A top U.S. health official on Sunday warned that the country is in a new phase of the novel coronavirus outbreak, with infections, quote, extraordinarily widespread in rural areas as well as big cities. Dr. Deborah Birx, the White House Coronavirus Task Force coordinator, told CNN's State of the Union, quote, "What we are seeing today is different from March and April. It is extraordinarily widespread. To everybody who lives in a rural area, you are not immune or protected from this virus." Birx said people living in multi-generational households in areas with outbreaks should wear masks inside the home to protect the elderly or those with underlying conditions. Birx also said the Trump administration has been working on individual reports for each state examining community trends and hospital records. But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said on Sunday she does not have confidence in Birx, linking her to disinformation spread by President Trump. Pelosi told ABC's This Week, quote, "I think the president has been spreading disinformation about the virus and she is his appointee, so I don't have confidence there, no." Birx, asked on CNN about Pelosi's comment, said she had great respect for the speaker and attributed the criticism to a New York Times article on the White House pandemic response that described Birx as having embraced overly optimistic assessments on the virus. Birx added, quote, "I've never been Pollyannish, nor non-scientific or non-data-driven. I will stake my 40-year career on those fundamental principles of using data to implement better programs and save lives." The coronavirus has infected 4.6 million people in the U.S. and killed more than 155,000 Americans, according to a Reuters tally.
The White House and top congressional Democrats remain at odds over the scope of more assistance for 30 million American workers left unemployed by the coronavirus pandemic. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, appearing on Sunday talk show, said that she still had some disagreement with Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin over how much new aid the national government should approve. Top Trump administration officials are expected to resume negotiations with Democratic congressional leaders today on a bill aimed at buffering the economic impact of the coronavirus pandemic. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
We have to renew the unemployment insurance, and not just for a week.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says a long-term extension of the expired $600 per week supplemental unemployment benefit is one of four essentials, along with renter and homeowner protections, aid to state and local governments, and funding to ensure schools are able to open safely.
We have to balance. There's obviously a need to support workers.
On ABC's This Week, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin had this.
On the other hand, we have to be careful about not piling on enormous amounts of debt for future generations.
Schumer counters.
We can underfund what's needed, and it will cost us more in the long run because COVID will still stay with us.
Ben Thomas, Washington.
Meanwhile, a spokesperson for the Republican National Convention says that the vote to renominate President Donald Trump, which is set for later this month, will now be conducted in private without members of the media present because of the coronavirus. Last month, President Trump called off the public components of the convention in Florida citing spiking cases of the virus across the country. In last week, President Trump, facing low poll numbers, suggested that the country should delay the election due to fears of voter fraud, which left many wondering, does the president have such powers as to delay the elections? VOA's Lori London spoke to Joe Paul, professor of constitutional law at UC Hastings Law School in San Francisco.
No, it's not anything the president can do. The time and manner of the election is determined by Congress. And Congress has set the date for the election as November 3rd. Moreover, the president doesn't have the authority to delay the time when he leaves office because the Constitution sets out that he has to leave office at noon on January 20th. So the president isn't in any way able to delay the election or to delay his time leaving office.
There have been growing concerns given the president speaking a lot about mail-in balloting and concerns about election fraud. If it were to come to the election and the president, as he's saying, he believes it's going to be rigged and he won't accept the results, what happens?
The president can continue to question the legitimacy of the election, and I imagine in doing so, he may discourage some people from voting or discourage some people from voting by mail. But ultimately, the Constitution doesn't require the president to accept the results of the election, whether he accepts them or not. The election is decided by the votes of the Electoral College. And once the Electoral College votes, that determines the election. Now, that doesn't mean that the president couldn't attempt something extra-constitutional. But from what the leaders of the Senate said, it appears that he would not have the support even of his own party. And the question would ultimately depend on Congress to forcibly remove him from office if it came to that.
So should Americans be concerned that the president will do something to damage the integrity of our democratic election process?
Well, I think the president, in fact, is doing that right now. He continually questions the reliability of voting by mail. He suggested that there's fraud. He has taken no efforts at all to prevent a foreign government like Russia from interfering in the election. And all of this, I think, is quite damaging in terms of the confidence the electorate has in the outcome of the election. But he can't affect the election itself. He can affect people's attitudes about the election, but he can't change the result and he can't prevent the election from occurring.
Joe Paul is a professor of constitutional law at UC Hastings Law School in San Francisco. He was speaking to VOA's Lori London. Two NASA astronauts returned to Earth on Sunday in a dramatic retro-style splashdown, the first of its kind in 45 years. The astronauts were aboard the first commercially built and operated spacecraft to carry people to and from orbit. The return clears the way for another SpaceX crew launch as early as next month and future tourist flights to space. Australia's Victoria declared a state of disaster on Sunday after struggling to contain the spread of the new coronavirus in its capital, Melbourne. For more on this, David Doyle reports.
A state of disaster was declared in Australia's Victoria on Sunday, with a nightly curfew imposed for its capital, Melbourne, as a part of its harshest restrictions on movement to date. The measures were announced by Regional Premier Daniel Andrews.
Regional Victoria will move to stage three restrictions, that's stay at home except for the four reasons to leave. That will mean that restaurants, cafes, bars, gyms, a whole range of other settings, we're well and truly acquainted with those, will need to close from midnight next Wednesday. That is not the position we wanted to be in, but we cannot have a situation where this continues to grow and grow in regional Victoria.
The curfew, from 8 p.m. until 5 a.m, bars Melbourne's nearly 5 million population from leaving their houses except to receive or give care or for work. Australia's second largest city, already under a reimposed six-week stay-at-home order, has struggled to contain the new coronavirus, with a record number of infections reported last week. On Sunday, Victoria confirmed 671 new cases, one of its highest totals, and seven COVID-19 deaths. The new restrictions will limit the amount of time Melbourne residents can spend on outdoor exercise and essential shopping, and schools will move to remote learning from Wednesday. The state of disaster, which was supported by Prime Minister Scott Morrison, also gives police additional powers to ensure the public comply with the measures. Australia has fared better than many countries in containing the spread of the new coronavirus, though at a high economic cost. It's recorded around 18,000 coronavirus cases, but authorities say more than 11,500 of those are in Victoria, where the recent surge has proved difficult to contain.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security official who oversaw the intelligence division at the department has been reassigned after reports that his office had gathered intelligence reports on two U.S. journalists. Last week, the Washington Post reported that DHS had gathered intelligence on two U.S. journalists who published and leaked unclassified government documents while covering protests in Portland, Oregon. After the revelations, Acting Secretary of Homeland Security Chad Wolf instructed the office to stop collecting information on the press, and he ordered an investigation into its proceedings. Jack Rice is a criminal defense attorney and former CIA officer. He says that collecting such intelligence on journalists is highly problematic because it's often a hallmark of undemocratic governments.
DHS says that they have reassigned the official who was in charge of this intelligence division that was collecting intelligence on reporters. Do we know what kind of intelligence was collected, and is this traditionally something that the DHS does?
Well, here's the problem that we have right now. Anytime you have DHS starting to collect information using means that you use for terrorist groups, but you're applying it to journalists inside the United States, that is a very, very scary operation because of the impact that it has on the First Amendment and a whole series of other issues and the chilling effect that it can have in the nation. So a very, very big deal.
And in this case, again, do we have an idea on what kind of intelligence it was?
We don't have all of the information that was being collected by DHS. What we do know is it's more than just the names. It was also about locations. It was about some of the public information that was coming out. So in other words, tweets and everything else. And so there were some of the public pieces, but the fact that the processes that they were using were specifically designed to track separatist groups, terrorist groups, and violent extremists. That's what they were designed for. And in fact, Brian Murphy himself, who was before a Senate committee saying, this is not something we did, when you find out, in fact, this is exactly what it was that DHS was doing, is pretty scary indeed.
And who provides oversight in such cases? And essentially, what are the laws governing such intelligence gathering?
Well, see, that's part of the problem, because intelligence sort of falls under the bailiwick of multiple different groups. Ultimately, there is oversight within DHS itself. So you're going to see some of that. There's also oversight in other areas of the U.S. government, but here's where they collide. They collide with First Amendment protections of the U.S. Constitution. And so that oversight sort of supersedes almost everything else. But because so much of this information is classified, what you get is the government's ability to do extraordinary things without the knowledge of the American people. So you don't get transparency. And you, what you do get is a powerful organization who can do extraordinary things, and the American people don't actually know it. That is horrifying.
And what could that information be potentially used for?
Well, the real problem is that the United States has a history of doing this. So what they do is they will decide what is dangerous. Guess what? They decided that Martin Luther King was dangerous in 1960. They decided that certain people were perpetuating or supporting terrorist organizations or organizations that undercut and destabilize the United States. That can be anybody that you see as opposing your philosophical belief. So this could undercut civil rights groups. This could undercut journalists. This could undercut educational organizations. This could undercut political organizations that are protected by the Constitution itself. And you're using the weight of the U.S. government to do that. What we're seeing and what we have seen historically in the U.S. and honestly across the earth is that governments in positions of power will regularly define their political enemies as enemies of the state. Then you use the power of the state to undermine and sometimes even crush them. And we've seen that throughout the world, and this has happened in the U.S. as well.
Mm. Now, the acting DHS secretary, speaking earlier on the situation in Portland, he says that the DHS plans to remain in Portland until they can, quote, be assured that the courthouse is safe and secure. How has the presence of federal security actually affected the protests in that place?
The problem is it's not just Portland. We have seen federal authorities in Chicago, in Kansas City, and other places as well. And there's a real question on whether or not there is a justification for federal authorities being there. First of all, we have seen that it's been causing instability. But more importantly, the real question is whether or not they even have jurisdiction, meaning they have the right to be there doing what they're doing. We have heard reports that federal authorities have been in the streets of Portland, and if they're not protecting a federal facility, there is no justification, no legal reason for them to be there. It is a local question. But if what you're getting is power coming from Washington, D.C., and deciding they're going to work in the states themselves, that simply is something that is inconsistent with how the United States has organized and controlled power of the police.
Is this something that would expect to have hearings on the Hill at any point?
Yes. I think there is, because we have already seen hearings in this last week when Attorney General Barr was before Congress talking about putting federal officers in the streets and whether or not they're actually protecting American citizens or whether or not they're trampling civil rights. And that is a conversation that people should continue to have.
Jack Rice is a criminal defense attorney and former CIA officer. I reached him in Minnesota. An emergency committee on COVID-19 was convened by the World Health Organization to assess the current status of the pandemic. It's calling for global solidarity in supporting efforts to contain it. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Not surprisingly, the emergency committee for the fourth time has unanimously agreed that COVID-19 constitutes a public health emergency of international concern. When the committee first made this declaration on January 30th, there were fewer than 100 cases and no deaths outside China. Now, 6 months later, the World Health Organization is reporting more than 17 million cases globally, including more than 750,000 deaths, with more than half the number of cases and deaths occurring in the Americas. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says this is a sobering reminder of the gargantuan task that lies ahead.
The pandemic is a once-in-a-century health crisis, the effects of which will be felt for decades to come. Many countries that believed they were past the worst are now grappling with new outbreaks.
The nearly three dozen experts and advisors who met virtually have come up with a range of recommendations to guide national and international efforts to combat the pandemic. One is to coordinate regional and global commitments to the development of vaccines and therapeutics. Tedros understands the hopes vested in finding a safe and effective vaccine and medications to treat the disease. However, he cautions people to lower their expectations.
Although vaccine development is happening at record speed, we must learn to live with this virus and we must fight it with the tools we have.
The emergency committee says public health and social measures are some of the best tools that communities have for fighting the new coronavirus. These involve testing, tracing, social distancing, wearing masks, and hand washing. The committee advises states to maintain active community-based COVID-19 surveillance systems. It calls upon them to share information on travel measures based on risk assessments so international travel can safely resume. It also urges states to counter misinformation and false information about COVID-19 that undermine efforts to combat the pandemic. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. The coronavirus pandemic is making its way into prisons nationwide, and that is particularly true at San Quentin State Prison in California, where more than 50% of the 3,500 inmates have tested positive for COVID-19, the disease caused by the virus. But there are efforts to release some prisoners early and enact other measures to try and keep inmates safe. Diana Mitchell reports.
Demonstrators chained themselves to the gate in front of California Governor Gavin Newsom's Sacramento home, calling for mass release of prison inmates statewide due to COVID-19 outbreaks in the state's prisons. For Chanda Williams, the fight is personal. She has been teaching yoga to inmates at San Quentin State Prison for the past 6 years. The prison has the worst coronavirus outbreak in the state's prison system, which houses more than 100,000 inmates. Williams has written letters urging authorities to release prisoners.
These people were sentenced for crimes. They were not sentenced to die in prison, and certainly not by the negligence of the state. The state has a responsibility to maintain their health and their safety and their well-being, and the state has failed in that. The CDCR has failed in that.
Like other institutions caught off guard by the virus, prisons in the U.S. have struggled with how to keep people, inmates and staff, safe. California is conducting widespread testing, and the governor has given early releases to about 3,500 inmates to ease overcrowding. But there have been setbacks, like in May, when it's believed prisoners transferred from the California Institution for Men in Chino to San Quentin brought the virus with them. In early July, J. Clark Kelso, the court-appointed federal receiver for the state's prison medical care system, addressed inmates in a video.
We are making unprecedented changes to our operations. And we recognize the burden this has placed on those incarcerated in our prisons.
At San Quentin, at least 19 inmates have died of coronavirus, including 10 on death row. Nationwide, more than 70,000 prisoners have tested positive, and at least 100 have died, according to the Federal Bureau of Prisons. One of Williams' students, 41-year-old Chan Thun Bun, tested positive July 1st, the day he was released. Bun was not given early release, but earned parole, he says, after serving 23 years of a 50-year sentence. He called the prison's handling of COVID-19 cases a chaotic experience.
Because they had this thing where they like, you guys got to space out. And we told them, we can't space out in our cell. Our cell is 5 by 9 by 14. And then they came out with a memo, you guys got to sleep head to toe. And we're like, what does that do?
The prison did not respond to a request for comment. In a video to the prison community, officials proposed steps to increase physical distancing, like moving inmates to alternative housing or other prisons, and changing schedules to allow for more sanitation. The inmates released so far were within 180 days of completing their sentences. The state is planning to release several thousand more, but says it must be done carefully. Here's California Governor Gavin Newsom in a press conference.
You don't want to just send people out into park benches in homeless shelters. We've got to make sure that we responsibly move people out, but with a deep sense of urgency.
Sharon Dolovich, the director of the UCLA Prison Law and Policy Program, weighs in.
Releases on a much bigger scale than what we're seeing need to happen if we're going to keep people safe.
While officials say they are working to release more inmates as a way to limit those exposed to coronavirus, advocates continue to protest, saying it's not happening fast enough. For VOA News, Dina Mitchell, Oakland, California.
Malawi President Lazarus Chakwera has announced the introduction of a special award for most dedicated healthcare workers in the fight against COVID-19. Speaking during his weekly national address, Jacquera said that five health workers nominated by various medical associations will be receiving the award every 3 months for their dedication to work. But health workers say that awarding only five people is not good enough. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi continues to register an increase in the cases of COVID-19. At the coronavirus situation update report from the Presidential Task Force on COVID-19 shows as of the Saturday evening, Malawi had 4,186 cases of COVID with 20 deaths. The report also said about 100 new cases are being confirmed every day, whose transmission is now almost entirely local. However, President Chakwera said despite the spike in confirmed COVID-19 cases, nearly half of those found with the virus have already recovered fully. He says this is largely a credit to our healthcare workers who have bravely put themselves at risk to test hundreds of people every day, giving quarantine guidelines to those who are found positive and providing care to those in need of hospitalization. Chakwera described the health workers as champions who are sacrificing their lives against many odds, including depressing working conditions, depleted medical supplies, and deteriorating health facilities. He says without them, we would simply have no chance and no hope against this pandemic because they are truly our last line of defense. Chakwera introduced the Zikomo Presidential Award as a token of thanks to the most dedicated healthcare workers. Health workers say they appreciate the gesture, but say awarding only five health workers is not a good idea. Shouts Meza is the chairperson for Human Resource for Health Coalition. He told VOA via telephone that currently every health worker is working hard to the extent that some are even getting infected with the coronavirus. Statistics show that about 350 health workers have so far tested COVID-19 positive in Malawi with one death.
Probably the award, in my view, and representing all health workers in Malawi, there should be a universal standard award to all health workers. And I would propose, if you like, that maybe the award would be a temporary waiver of tax on salaries for health workers.
Smeza says besides awards, the government should also consider addressing the shortage of medical workers in public hospitals, which is affecting the fight against the spread of coronavirus. Health Minister Khumbize Chiponda says the government is addressing that.
We are trying very hard. We have managed to get about 700 health workers, different cadres, nurses, clinicians, medical assistants, health surveillance assistants, just to try to manage to bridge the gap. It is not enough, but we have to start from somewhere.
President Chakwera has asked Malawians to observe preventive measures against the pandemic, which include social distancing, wearing face coverings, and regular hand washing, as the country works to formulate laws to enforce these measures. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Music fans have voted, and the winner is Beyoncé's stunning new visual album, Black is King. The project, which premiered this weekend on the streaming site Disney Plus, has received mostly positive reviews as a visually inventive piece of storytelling, exploring the themes of Black legacy and generational learning through the thin veil of the Lion King story. You've been listening to International Edition. That is it for our show today. But you can find us anytime at voanews.com. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Thanks so much for listening. Please take care and be well.